Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, okay. Thank you.
Great. House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a work session on introduction of committee legislative concepts. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, welcome back to Salem. The first item on your agenda is the introduction of committee LCs, committee bills for the 14th session. You have three of them on your OLS, LC 166, which is a is based on the language that you developed at the end of last session on reforming the manufacturing facilities investment tax credit. And then you have LC 167, which is a general cleanup language for House Bill 3601, which was your special session revenue bill. So there's a number of things that we caught as we went through, and I think you've had some testimony on that in November. So those are captured in that LC 167.
Technical fixes,
yes. And LC 169 is your annual reconnect bill.
I'm sorry, the annual
reconnect.
The reconnect.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 166, LC 167, and LC 169 be introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves LC 166, 167, and 169 be introduced as committee bills for the 2014 regular session. I'll note that, as usual, our practice has been since Representative Shetterly was chair of the committee many years ago, that bill introduction is a matter of courtesy. Does not imply that a member of the committee voting for the motion has any particular opinion about the bill or would vote for it were it to come to a work session later to the floor. It's simply a matter of introduction. Is there any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Without objection, the motion passes. Thank you. That's very helpful. With that, those will be introduced. We are a couple minutes early, but I think I see members here who are ready to present. Yes, please, Paul.
A minute, Mr. Chair.
Let me close the work session. And Paul, go ahead.
I wanted to remind the committee about House Bill 2002, which made some modifications to what our responsibilities are. And one of the consequences of that bill was to give us an additional position. So we did go out and nationally recruit in the job openings for Economist publication, American Economic Association, but we ended up hiring someone close to home, and he is here, Vijay Satyal, who started this at the first of the year in January. He's a graduate of Oregon State University and comes to us from the Department of Energy, where he's worked for 5 years on a number of the issues that this committee has been dealing with. So we're very happy to have him.
He understands the Red Sea, doesn't he?
He does. And the Red Sea, too.
Bravo. Great. Welcome.
He's one up on it.
Thank you very much for coming to work with the legislature. I think you will find that this is a very interesting place to work. And interesting is one of those neutral words which might mean wonderful one day and terrifying the next. Thank you. All right. So let's go ahead with our information meeting. And the first item on information meeting is presentation on potential member bills for 2014. I think we have four bills to be presented. Are there five bills? And I see three members here. Right, or four members here who want to present bills. Is that right?
Yeah, just briefly.
We have two committee members.
And we have two committee. Okay, so we have five people to present. One is presenting two different bills. You care who goes first? The object of this process is to let the committee know what's coming. We don't know exactly what bills the speaker is going to refer to us, but we have some pretty good guesses. And the object is to give us that. We have until 8:40, so let's briefly but thoroughly. Thank you. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast. I have two measures to share with you today. The first comes to you courtesy of Representative Nathanson, who could not be with us this morning, and I agreed to present you some information on her draft dealing with the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program. Just to give you some very quick background, the Property Tax Deferral Program for disabled and senior citizens was established nearly 30 years ago to provide assistance to low and moderate income homeowners. And until 2011, eligibility for the program was primarily based on age, that is 62, and household income, currently at $42,000. The program is intended to be self-sustaining and at its peak had about 11,000 qualified participants. Now, in the fall of 2010, the Department of Revenue notified the legislature that the program's reserves were depleted. And in order to ensure the program's long-term sustainability, there were several changes that were implemented at that time. For the eligibility requirements, in addition to the household income and the homeowner's age, the homeowner was required to have lived in the home and owned it for 5 years, to have homeowner's insurance, a net worth of $500,000 or less, excluding the value of the home. Good morning, Representative. and not to have a reverse mortgage. Now, the issue regarding reverse mortgages was actually changed in the last legislative session to grandfather in any individuals who had been in the program previously and were dropped out of it because they had reverse mortgages. Well, in addition, in recognition of the costs associated with administering the program, interest is charged on the balance of taxes that are paid by the Department of Revenue. And the program had utilized a simple interest rate of 6%. However, that was changed in 2011 so that the rate on accrued deferred tax balances was charged at 6% compounded annually. The intent of the compounded interest rate was to generate funds in excess of administrative costs and to help replenish the program's reserves. Now, the proposal that Representative Nathanson, who has just joined us, has put forward, is that property tax deferral program is growing and it has a positive projections for the future, and it's proposed that the interest rate on the deferred tax balances revert back to a simple interest rate of 6%. The program was never intended to be a revenue producer for the state, and further initial research indicates that no other state agency or program charges a compound interest rate on monies owed the state. Since the program's participation numbers are stable and the reserve funds replenished, it's only fair to reduce the interest charged on deferred balances and return to the previous simple interest rate. Now, what I'd like to add is two points. One is that my constituents come to me and say that they appreciate the opportunity to defer their property tax payments, but at the end of that process, whether the house is sold and they move to another place or whether the house is left to their heirs, they'd like something to be left besides the debt to the state. And the compound interest rate is having an effect on their opportunity to pass along their life's acquisitions to their heirs. The second issue is that we have again brought people into this program that have deferred mortgages. And the mortgage holders, the banks, are in the second position behind the state. So if the state is acquiring a profit on interest rates, that leaves a lesser asset over for the banks to recover their investment on deferred mortgages, which is a secondary but very important concern. So I hope the committee will view this proposal positively. We're looking for a simple solution rather than a compound one.
Representative Nathanson, did you want to be heard on your bill?
Mr. Chair and committee, I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. No, thank you. Representative Gomberg has done a nice job. I just want to underscore that we're just trying to help low and moderate income people with a program that they've appreciated having. And I think the explanation is quite sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for these two? Thank you very much. Useful discussion, and we are going to get a report later about how the fund is doing, and we'll know more after that, I suspect. Thank you very much. Who would like to go next?
Yes,
I'm sorry, you have another bill, don't you?
I do, Mr. Chairman.
So let's go,
I'd be happy to give somebody else a turn and come back, or I can jump right into it.
Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you. My own measure is LC 83, which deals with the small business tax break that we approved in the last special session. Just to refresh your memories, most large businesses in Oregon file as C corporations, and their profits are taxed at roughly 7%. Smaller businesses, family businesses, tend to file either as LLCs or as S corporations, and their profits are taxed as personal income, starting at about 9%, which is a long way of saying that small businesses tend to pay a higher tax rate than large businesses. I had a problem with that, which is why I supported the measure during the last special session. But that being said, I have two concerns about the measure that we passed. The first one deals with the smallest of the small businesses, the micro firms. We set a requirement in the bill that says that in order to qualify for this tax break, that you need to have essentially one full-time employee, somebody who works 30 hours a week for a cumulative total of 1,200 hours a year. That's not how it works in my district. It's not how it works in a lot of rural areas, not a lot of seasonal economies, where we have fishermen, where we have farmers, where we have dairymen, where we have tourism, that are not employing people full-time year-round. And so what I had proposed here is to lower that reduction slightly to 20 hours per week and to a total of 1,000 hours a week. And I'm trying, as I said, to address the smallest of small businesses, but I'm also looking at companies that hire working parents. I'm looking at companies that hire working seniors. I'm looking at the kind of environment in my own district where a lot of people who work full-time are actually doing so by holding three part-time jobs. And I want to make sure that these opportunities are expanded to include a lot more companies. By reducing the requirement to 20 hours per week, 1,000 hours per year, legislative revenue informed us that we would actually include nearly 8,000 more employers. 8,000 more small employers would be included if we made those simple changes, bringing, as I said, the opportunity to the smallest of the small companies, the people that are beginning to grow, the people that are beginning to create jobs and beginning to create a future for themselves, particularly in the seasonal and the rural economies. The total cost of those 8,000 businesses would be roughly $7 million. One concern. The second concern I have is that we passed a measure, and frankly, we don't know what it's going to cost. We know what it would cost today, considering the kind of businesses that we have, and the numbers that I've got suggest that currently we have about 80,000 S corporations, LLCs in the state that would be subject to these new tax rates. Of those 80,000, about half of them, 40,000 of them, report profits or income of less than $25,000 a year and are getting a roughly $130 tax break. At the other end of the spectrum, we've got 250 companies that are reporting profits of over $1 million a year and are receiving a tax break of roughly $40,000 annually. $40,000, which is more than most wage earners in my district earn in a year. Now, let me say very clearly that I've got nothing wrong with companies being successful, and I congratulate those companies that are out there making a difference and making money. Good for them. But my concern is that we've got a lot of other companies that have a different kind of status who may change their corporate status to take advantage of these new opportunities, these new breaks that that we have passed. And we have no idea how many are out there, how much they're making, and what this program is going to cost. And I submit to you that I think it's awkward public policy to implement measures when we don't have any idea what it's going to cost us in the short run or the long run. And so my proposal was to cap the profits that are subject to this new tax rate at $250,000. That's not eliminating companies that make more than $250,000. It's simply saying that the amount of money that would be subject to the break would be limited to $250,000, which would turn out to be about a $5,000 tax break. I'd suggest to you that 6 months ago, those larger companies would have been delighted with news of a $5,000 tax break. It's only now that we've suggested they may get $40,000 that they that may be concerned about the difference. In any event, if we were to cap this program taxing or applying the break to the first $250,000, we would net the state about $24 million in savings. There are about 3,000 companies in the category I'm talking about. So in summary, what my measure suggests is that we limit the tax savings of the S corporations and LLCs that are making more than $250,000 a year per tax filer, with a savings of about $24 million and affecting about 3,000 companies. But on the other end, we include about 8,000 new companies, small companies, rural companies, seasonal economy companies, at a cost of about $7,000. That's the measure that I brought before you.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yes, just a quick question. Representative, in your LC draft, did the drafter indicate that this would be a tax-raising measure and require a 36 vote?
The draft did not indicate that to me.
Thank you.
Other questions for Representative Gunn? Thank you. Appreciate your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
We have several others. Representative Olson was here next, so... Representative, thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I am state representative out of the Albany area. But you're receiving a packet right now. This is going to be really quick. I'm going to give you a snapshot of what LC 226 looks like. It's the Oregon Health Benefit Dividend Plan. This is something that's been kind of surfacing the last 5 years. Some different forms have passed through the health care. It's at a point now where what we're wanting to try to do is to move forward also as a dividend, as a subtraction from federal revenue, and actually making healthy life choices and being involved in participation of some type of a program that turns your life around. The one piece I wanted to share with you and just kind of whet your appetites a little bit, hopefully, to get in front of you next month, is Corvallis, Albany, Lincoln, and Benton counties have a hospital system known as the Samaritan Health Services. Larry Mullins is the doctor, CEO, president of that organization, and Representative Gelser and I know him. But over the last few years, they have been working really hard toward wanting to improve the health care of their employees. Now, they have close to 5,000 employees. 80% of them have moved in toward this, over 80%, and the story that I had, you have a copy there of, explains that just briefly. But this LC 226 almost mirrors that of what they've done. They have really shown some great success in what they've done of just $300 to employees who want to participate. This here is $500 as the subtraction or the deduction from the federal income tax. This is a brainchild of Dr. Jack Jones, who's a doctor in Albany. He has been doing this himself within his ranks and his business for a number of years. And, again, he finds that it's up over 80% for the participation. I'm hopeful that when we do come in here next month, I will bring a story for you that's just going to knock the socks off of you, of a gal that works over at Samaritan Health Services that had lost 100 pounds as a result of this, and you'd never know that she was that heavy at one time. But this was a great mechanism for her to step forward toward a good, healthy life choice. And I think that this is a great opportunity to open up a door for small business, and I hope that you strongly consider moving forward with this.
This is a tax credit to the employer who makes a payment to an employee for participation in the wellness program. Have I got that right?
Paul, the way I understand it, it's not a tax credit. It's a subtraction, a deduction.
It's a deduction.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the summary language is there. It's a subtraction. So that would be the same issues we talked about around the senior medical. You'd be able to subtract it regardless of whether you itemize or not.
Okay, but the subtraction goes to the employer who has made a payment to an employee in connection with a wellness program.
I believe that's correct.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, and one other thing, just to close, I will have a good lineup for you, too, that will really... I mean, great, solid evidence, too. So.
Great.
Thank you
very much. Representative Unger? And there are two members of the committee who want to talk as well after you.
Oh, after me. Okay.
But I don't see anyone else here, so we'll assume that you plus the two committee members. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Unger, and I represent House District 29, which is the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, and Forest Grove. Thanks for having me today. For your consideration, I have for you LC 180, which the simplest way to describe it is a bill that would put school district funds in a lockbox so that they could not be abated by local governments for tax breaks for a variety of different purposes. I come to this bill knowing that we made a lot of progress on school funding in our last session. We still, though, have a $1.9 billion gap in order to make sure that we provide the quality education that our kids in this state need. There are not a lot of easy sources of revenue for that gap, but one of the places where I found we actually have a huge impact on our schools are the tax breaks and abatements that happen through local governments that then come and take a big chunk out of our school district budgets. To give you some sense of the size of the impact, the global loss for school districts from local government tax abatements is $378.8 million on school districts. Almost $400 million gets taken out of school district coffers without the school board or without the legislature giving it the A-OK. And that money could obviously be used for hiring thousands of teachers, extending school years, solving a lot of the problems that we know we need to address. We've addressed some of the losses that happen when we have tax breaks and abatements, especially through the SIP program. When the legislature created the gain share program a couple of years ago, that helps reimburse local governments for the losses that they endure when they do economic development. We haven't yet figured out how to deal with the school district losses, though. And so my solution, while straightforward, is definitely not uncontroversial, would be to simply say you can't take any of the school district money at all. And so that's the bill that's coming before you. The LC in its current draft isn't exactly how we want it, but we're working on trying to make it to fit this model, which would be to put everything, both SIPs, urban renewal development dollars, all of the school district money that gets taken out of the coffers, and just protect it and say, you can't take it. So there you go.
Okay. So you'll need a new relating clause, won't you?
We're working on it right now.
Okay, great. Any questions for Representative Unger? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate your presentation. Now, there are committee members who want to present. I know Representative Vega Peterson wants to. Do you want to do it from there, or do you want to go down to the...
I can do it from here.
I think so.
Yeah. So thank you, Chair. My LC is LC 211, and this is the has to do with the broadcaster bill that we had a pretty detailed hearing on in November. And the focus of the bill is to update the method that state taxes are levied on broadcasters. Instead of using an estimated audience size based on the number of audience viewers in a state, it changes it, and so that it has to do with the gross receipts of a broadcaster based on if the home state of the commercial activity for their customers is based in Oregon. We're working on with LRO and with the Department of Revenue to really focus on what exactly that those numbers would mean for Oregon. The rough estimate is that it would be $1 million increase. This isn't necessarily doing it because it's going to be an estimate, a revenue raiser or a revenue decreaser. It's more in updating the method that we allot these taxes based on the technology that's being used. Instead of having three broadcast television stations that are the major purchasers for broadcasters, we're now looking at internet, cable, satellite, as well as broadcast television. And so this is just updating the methodology to make sense with how people are getting their broadcast media today. And one of the things that I will let you know that will be in addition to the LC is that we'll be adding an amendment to add a sunset to this so that we will have time to look and make sure that this is having the effect that we intend it to have for Oregon. So you will see that amendment when we bring it forward in the session.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Representative Vega Peterson? Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. Who else did we have? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of you have seen the so-called
call bird seed tax concept over the last 5 or 6 years. And it's been suggested that it apply just to wild birds. It struck me some time ago, like 2 years, that Eastern Oregon, two-thirds of the state, was in danger of suffering the same consequences as the timbered area in Oregon, the spotted owl situation is approaching, but this time it's disguised as a sage grouse. And the trouble we have is that two-thirds of my district, about 15 million acres, is included as core habitat or very important habitat for the grouse. The issue is whether or not it's going to be listed. And if it's that listing decision will take place about a year and a half from now. It's hard to tell, really, when you talk to U.S. Fish and Wildlife about what's going to be determinative about the listing. It's difficult. They have very, very complex standards that are applied. But it does appear that the state of Oregon has a good chance of not enduring another listing, such as the spotted owl situation, if the state has embarked upon a program of preservation that parallels or would be at least equal to that which U.S. Fish and Wildlife might impose through the listing. So I really can't express how damaging this could be to two-thirds of our state, other than to point out what we've endured with our lumber and timber businesses. So there's every reason to try to figure out how we might reduce the chances of the listing. With this in mind, I've spoken with the folks that brought the birdseed tax idea and said, how about if we go forward with this, dividing it between wild birds in general and sage grouse in particular? They were not enthusiastic. I don't know why. I went to a number of my own constituents, and they are equally unenthusiastic about any word that starts with T and ends in X.
It has three letters.
Right, exactly. And so
this
has been
okay?
A challenge. The bill that you have before you is a draft of most of the ideas that have come up, and I'm sure when you see it again, it'll be much shorter. The conversations that need to happen are happening. In fact, this morning, there was a telephone conference call among many of the cattlemen over and women over whether or not to support different elements of this concept. Those discussions continue. The discussions between folks on the ground and environmental organizations continue. So as I say, it's something that I hope to be able to bring back that everyone agrees with, and I would say that would happen in the next 2 weeks or not at all. So I appreciate your time and look forward to further discussions regarding this important issue.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Vance? You're right that this bill has come up several times before. It's always been mischaracterized. This isn't really a tax bill. This is really a bill to avoid federal interference in the operation of our land use. And I think if it's framed correctly, that you improve the odds of getting people to stop thinking about T and X and thinking instead about what the effect of the rest of the bill is. I did note that you've got a much better relating clause than the bill has had before, relating to wild bird conservation, which of course is what the whole point of this bill is. I'm sure that I suspect that the representative from District 60 does not want to be associated with a wild bird seed tax. I suspect that being associated with preserving our right to manage our own land would be a better association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The phrase we're using is the Avian Sustainability Initiative. It's actually the phrase.
Moving to my district?
Anyway, I appreciate your remarks. The amount that we're talking about is very modest.
It's small, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But the message it sends to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife folks is that Oregon is serious about protecting the grouse, and we better be, or the result is going to be extraordinarily negative, not just for those that have cattle on the land, but for anybody like wants to use it for recreation or mining or transmission lines or any other thing that you want to do across about 15 million acres of Oregon.
Wind power generation?
Solar power generation, geothermal power generation, anything having to do with a structure that runs across land, like a fence or like a power line. So these issues are huge to the future of this state. And it gives me an opportunity again to mention that two-thirds of the state is on the other side of the Cascades, two-thirds of it. And this affects a huge part of that two-thirds. Yeah.
Thank you. So my suspicion is that if it's possible to get those other considerations into the conversation about the bill, it has a better shot than otherwise.
I agree.
Your ranchers need a bill like this. People interested in the environment need a bill like this. They want to protect the grouse, but they also want to do those other things you mentioned.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Anything else for Representative Bantz? Representative Berger?
Yes, I'm sorry, members. I didn't get this to Paul in advance, and I would appreciate it if you would not groan when I mention the subject of my bill. It is a prepaid wireless. No groaning.
Nice.
As you know, I have been, this is a growing segment of the marketplace, and I am not a proponent of the current way that we tax it, and I believe that it is a tax that should be borne appropriately by the purchaser, and the only way to ensure that in my mind is with a point of sale system. And if we don't, it's auditable, it's a clean way to get at the funding of what I consider to be a critical critical service. That being said, it kind of got, the groans were legitimate. So my bill basically takes the last best offers in the Senate last session, where they were when this discussion ended in the Senate at the end of the last session, and starts there. Rather than reinventing the wheel, let's start where they were talking about it in the Senate, and I am proposing that as a starting place for further conversation, and that is the substance of my bill, which I presume would be most appropriate in this venue. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Berger? Thank you. And you didn't get very many groans at all.
Well, right? I knew there'd be groans.
Okay. All right, great. Is there any other member who would like to present a concept to the committee? I don't see anybody here. That doesn't mean, of course, we won't consider other bills that come in, and certainly the speaker assigns us a bill, we'll look carefully at it. With that, we'll move on then to our 840 item, which is only 3 minutes early. Options for extending renewable manufacturing facilities credit. Business Oregon and Legislative Revenue Office.
Mr. Chair, I'll start off. As I mentioned, when you introduced concepts for committee bills, LC 166 is an extension of the it's a reform of the manufacturing facilities renewable credit, and you had a lot of discussion about that. So we essentially introduced that as a placeholder, and our intent here today is to kind of bring you up to date where the thinking is. We've asked Paul Grove from Business Oregon to talk with you about the thinking there, and Chris has put together some information about not so much the credit and how the credit is formed, but how we structure the credit in order to get the money to the targeted area and what those options are. Things we've talked about with you kind of offline for a couple of years, and we thought it would be helpful maybe to lay those out and get thinking about that, what those options are.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with Business Oregon. Appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. Director McCabe had a long-standing commitment that he had to attend this morning, so he was unfortunately not able to be before you. But this is an issue and an item that's of
great importance to him and to the department as a whole. I know Chris is going to walk through some of the administrative options of the credit, and you guys are going to engage in a discussion on that piece. More than anything, from the department's perspective, we understand that there are a lot of issues and items to work through with respect to the credit and to its administration. Bottom line is that we would hope that you would at least consider a short-term extension of the program as it currently exists with respect to renewable resource manufacturing facilities. There are a couple of options or items that are out there in discussions that we are having with prospective companies looking at Oregon, and having that tool at our disposal helps the state standing with respect to those discussions. So that is the message from the director today before for you, and I will be happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability and turn it over to Chris.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Chris Allenite, Legislative Revenue Office. And I'm just going to touch on a couple of options for how tax credits can be structured. I think the committee is very familiar with these options, but just context for the potential reworking of the manufacturing Betsy. And the current structure, as the committee is aware, is a transferable multi-year tax credit, which has a number of advantages and disadvantages, all of which I won't go into. Again, the committee is very familiar with that, having lived through the Betsy for several years. But at a high level, one of the advantages is that it extends the tax credit and the funding to non-taxable entities by making it transferable. So you can have a nonprofit or non-taxable entity that can undertake an eligible project and get tax credit, and then they can sell it to a taxable entity. The multi-year nature spreads out the revenue impact over a number of years, and the transferable piece also directs the capital directly to the project owner. And so that's kind of the current structure. The two major possibilities for reworking the credits are, one, to make the credit refundable, and two would be a tax credit auction, both of which the state has experience in. A refundable tax credit is often more appealing to recipients than a multi-year credit, because the revenue received can be in that first year and it will go directly to that taxpayer, albeit it'll be at the end of the tax year, but they will just claim that tax credit, whatever that amount is, and it all goes directly to the project owner or the taxpayer. The revenue impact can be more contained in that it doesn't have these long tails in terms of the revenue impact. So there's more clarity around what the revenue impact will be, because it is refundable. It'll all go out to the taxpayers. And there can be caps set on programs to control the cost of the tax credit program, as has been done before. There is an ease of administration with respect to the tax credit. The tax credit gets claimed in a given year, and it all is contained within that 1 year. Neither an administrative agency such as Business Oregon or the Department of Revenue has to worry about a taxpayer being eligible for a number of years and keeping track of that tax credit. Under the current structure, there are 13 years for which a tax credit can eventually be claimed. It's a five-year credit with an eight-year carry forward. And that's a long period of time to be keeping track of, well, is this taxpayer actually eligible for the tax credit? So there is an ease of administration. But along with that, there is a potential fiscal impact with a refundable tax credit. The refundable credits we have now, the Department of Revenue they've had to change their system to accommodate the refundable credits. And just raise it here as a flag that may or may not be an issue as DOR undergoes some system changes. But in the past, we've seen a revenue impact associated with that, and that's basically been the case for every refundable credit we've seen. The potential here could also be extending the refundability credit to C corporations. Under current law, we don't have any refundable credits for C corporations, but this potentially could be. And as I said before, the money flows directly to the project owners. The next possibility is a tax credit auction. And the state currently has two credits that are sold via auction, the film and video credit and the renewable energy development credit. And so if the committee wanted to explore this avenue, we do have some experience on which we can build and learn from. I believe the experience has been a little bit different. The film and video has pretty much sold out their credit every year. And even when it gets expanded, that demand is there to soak up those new credits and to fund those projects. The renewable energy development program is newer, and the amount of credit sold isn't quite as high. But I haven't checked with the Department of Energy lately, but I don't believe we're selling those out. Again, I would need to check with the department. Last time I checked, they still had, there was unmet supply. And that could have to do with marketing. So that would be one thing the committee would want to look into. And
from a taxpayer's point of view, is there a difference between those two credits?
Mr. Chair, no, there isn't. They would just pay for a credit.
It's just a different name on it.
Right. If all you're looking at is lowering your tax bill, you know, the taxpayer's perspective is, do I pay $1,000 in tax, or do I pay $950 for a tax credit to get that $1,000? So that shouldn't be any different. So because these are new, we're still learning about the different factors in play here. There could be a number of different reasons, and we're exploring that. One of the big advantages of this is control over the revenue impact. The amount of tax credits to be auctioned can be set statutorily. It can be tied to any other means that the legislature would like, and have direct control over how much of the revenue impact there is. And it does maximize the efficiency of the tax credit. And this is where we've seen with the film and video credit, where we auction off $1,000 blocks and people bid on those blocks. And every year that the tax credits, that the film and video credits have been sold, people have been paying more and more for those tax credits. So it's gradually been inching up. Originally, it was 90 cents it was a 90% cost for a tax credit, and lately it's been up over 95%. So it increases the efficiency of that market. And it also would give greater flexibility over funds, because the credits sold would then be presumably deposited into an account for the discretion of Business Oregon, and a number of legislative parameters would obviously be set up over how that fund could be used. But then that gives greater flexibility potentially to the department to pick good projects and only fund them to whatever extent is necessary. Maybe it'd be a full funding, maybe a 10% funding. It would be funding for these actions and not those actions. So there is potential for greater flexibility there. And the last bullet point I put up there is the demand for these credits. And that just comes about with the initial experience, as I've already touched on, with the demand for film and video credits versus the renewable energy. From a taxpayer perspective, there's no difference. So that is something we'd want to look into, as to whether or not that really factors into how these credits could be sold easily. I know when I talk to CPAs and they're filling out the tax returns for the taxpayers, they very much like being able to go to Department of Revenue and look if there are any credits, one-year credits that they could buy to lower their client's tax liability. And I don't know that they really care if it's a film and video credit, renewable energy, or economic development, because, again, it's the tax perspective. But that this is something that we're continuing to look on as the state kind of wades into this auction experience with the tax credits.
Questions for these two? As I understand it, you'd take the existing law with a change of a sunset date, if I understood what you said correctly.
Chair Barnhart, yes, correct.
Okay. Great. I think it would be really helpful to know more, if we can do it quickly, about why it is that one agency seems to sell out and the other agency doesn't, so that we can establish an administrative or marketing function that will allow us to use this tool in the way that is most appropriate. It's hard for me to imagine that a taxpayer who is informed about these credits and has a tax liability and has an easy way to make a purchase wouldn't do it.
Mr. Chair, that is one of the things that we've thought about, is the marketing aspect. We do know that the Film and Video Office is very active in terms of marketing the credit. And if it's a simple marketing aspect, then that obviously presents certain solutions that can be resolved.
Yeah, I mean, if we don't have a, if one of our variables isn't can we sell these credits, but rather what do we want? What will help with our economic development? That simplifies our task quite a bit if we can get there. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you. Anything else for these two? Thank you so much. Paul, we're a little early.
Is
the analysis group here?
I don't know.
If they're not, do you want to take a break?
Yeah, why don't we take a 5-minute break? I can see if we could do property tax deferral.
Oh, okay. We may rejigger the agenda a little bit. So let's take a short recess, and we'll reconvene at 5 minutes to nine.
Have fun.
Correct.
Okay. You're going to present which item is it?
Marginally better than Elizabeth Stone.
The committee will come back to order. Colleagues, we're going to change the order of the agenda just a little bit to get us back on schedule and move to the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program update. So why don't you go ahead and make that presentation, and we have a statement from the department.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the property tax deferral has made its payments for November 2013, and the account balance that's remaining has come in a little bit over projection by about $3 million. This is most likely due to pent-up repayments from people that were out of the program and who did not have repayment due yet, but maybe voluntarily made repayment, possibly upon a refinance or something like that. And so I would not anticipate the long-term balance to be above projection because the repayments are just, it's a question of timing that they've come in this year rather than in future years. But today we have Bronson Ruta from the Department of Revenue to give us an update about the property tax deferral account and also to talk about the beginning of the implementation of House Bill 2510. And people have been notified about their eligibility under that provision.
Thank you. Christine, please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Bronson Rueda, and I am the manager of the deferral program in the property tax division at the Department of Revenue, and I'm filling in today for John Phillips, who is on vacation.
Good for him.
Good week. Paul Warner had asked the Department of Revenue to give a brief update on the status of the deferral program, specifically two areas. The first area was the financial situation of the deferral program, and also a little bit about the implementation of House Bill 2510, which you passed in the 2013 legislative session. So first up, the financial status of the deferral program. Christine stole a little bit of my thunder, but I'll go ahead and give you a review of what I have so far. In 2010, if you recall, the forecast for the deferral revolving account was in a deficit. And this was the result of a housing slowdown and economic downturn in Oregon, as fewer seniors were paying off their accounts and participation was growing substantially in the program. This resulted in less money to pay an increasing tax bill every November. Luckily for the citizens of Oregon, you took steps to salvage the program where other states had to terminate their program. Since then, the revolving account balance has stabilized, and this past November, we're actually at a surplus of nearly $8 million, as Christina stated. Going forward, we anticipate a monthly collection of approximately $1.55 million, which would leave us next November 2014 at a program balance of $10.6 million, better than what we anticipated. Moving on to the implementation of House Bill 2510, in 2011, the program participants were trimmed back significantly. You made a couple of steps to add participants back into the program. The first one was House Bill 4039 in 2012. You added the reverse mortgage. Those who had a reverse mortgage and had recertified in the program by February 1st were allowed to stay in the program for an additional 2 years, and since then they've been added in to perpetuity as of the 2013 session. Secondly, House Bill 2510, all those seniors who had previously been in the program and had a reverse mortgage or had been in their home for less than 5 years or both were allowed to reapply in 2014 as of January 2nd this year. So how have we implemented this program? First, we had to restructure the application. We made significant changes to the application and designed it so hopefully it would be easier for our seniors to follow as we have had some feedback to do so in the past. Early December, we sent out a letter to all those affected by House Bill 2510, and that was approximately 1,876 people. Now, applications can be turned in to the applicant's home county, where the application will then be directed to us. And the first 700 approved applicants this year will be allowed back into the program, and we're keeping track of that by having the county date stamp each application as it comes in. And per your direction, we're also maintaining this list going forward in case it does reach over 700, then 5% each year can be added back in after this 2014 season. And as of yesterday morning, we had 241 applications for this year's deferral program. However, unfortunately, we're not far enough into the process where we're able to determine how many of those 241 are from the 2510 House bill. Any questions?
Questions? Yes, Representative.
This isn't a question, but I wonder if you would forward, if you can electronically to the committee, a copy of this application. I would like to take a look at it. Do you have it electronically?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, yes, we have an electronic version, and I can get that to you.
I have heard, Mr. Chair, I have heard repeatedly, you know, oh, it's really hard, and I'm happy to hear that it's been one of the issues around this is these are seniors, and it's a complicated, and there's a lot of anxiety around, you know, a form and whatnot, and I'm very pleased to hear that you've made efforts to in that, and I just would like to take a look at the current thing just for my own curiosity.
Absolutely.
That's all I'm coming from.
Yeah, if you got it to Christine, she would get it to the rest of us.
And if it isn't electronic,
that would be very helpful. Of course, as these changes that we have made work their way through time-wise, then, of course, the application gets simpler again, doesn't it?
Mr. Chair, that's the hope, that it gets simpler.
Right. We've heard from Representative Nathanson this morning that she's bringing a bill that would change the way interest is calculated. I think it would be useful for you to work with Christine and with Representative Nathanson on what the effect that would have, if any, on the trust fund for our use in the session. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your coming this morning, giving us this presentation. And I think I can speak for the committee by saying that we're pleased to see this plus number at the bottom. This was a huge issue for us a couple of years ago.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Paul, should we go ahead to the greenhouse gas emission reduction update? Oh.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Last time we were here, we heard from Portland State University about the project we're conducting on the greenhouse emissions and the green tax, basically the fee for the. And today we're lucky to have. Sue Tierney, was an opportunity that we couldn't resist that she would be able to give us a presentation on initiatives and experiences from different states. So, head to view.
Great. Thank you very much. Just state your name for the record and then go ahead and make your presentation.
Terrific. My name is Sue Tierney. I hail from Boston, Massachusetts, where I work for an economic consulting firm called Analysis Group. I am originally from the West Coast. I love coming here every time I get a chance. So it's really an honor to be here to testify. Now, I understand that in theory there will be a presentation up here, but I don't see either icon that reflects mine. Push the space bar. Well, so this says, excuse me for being so, that one is not mine. And, oh, where did that come from?
We'll have to run it.
Okay, that's terrific. That's no problem. Although, is there a way to project it here or not?
Yes.
Nope. Don't you love electronic logistics? Mm-hmm. I really do apologize. While we're getting this set up, let me, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I had the pleasure of working in state government in Massachusetts for 15 years, cabinet officer and head of the Public Utility Commission. I am also a former federal official at the Department of Energy, head of policy. So it's great to be here. I think that states are where the action is on a number of energy policy issues.
Sorry.
That's all right. I have provided to the committee a six-page statement and have this accompanying PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to just give you the headlights from it, because I'm really here to answer your questions and follow your lead in letting me know what you're most interested in learning about. The punchline is that 2 years ago, colleagues and I did a study of the first 3 years of the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, a joint program of 10 states in the Northeast. I'll show you the map of which ones. The first 3 years, the bottom line was that this was a program that generated $912 million for 10 states during those 3 years, and it's a continuing program, so it is continuing to generate revenues for the states. The states used that nearly $1 billion in a number of different ways, which I'll describe. And the ways that they spent the money generated a $1.6 billion in economic value added to the regional economy, 16,000 job years, and reduced electricity customer bills over a 10-year period of time, where the tail-end effects of the spending of the $912 million created long-term savings on electricity bills of $1.1 billion. So this was a surprisingly nice outcome. Next slide, please. We were funded, my colleagues at Analysis Group and I were funded by foundations to do a study of the first 3 years of this program to see what the economic impacts were. So what we did was follow the money, which I'll describe in a little bit more detail. We had a peer review committee, and we used only actual data of what had happened in the 10-state area. Next slide, please. So let me describe a little bit about the mechanics of this program, because this is the basis for the collection of revenues by the states and the way in which this program entered the economy and had an effect on energy systems and greenhouse gas emissions in the 10-state area. So I'll be a little bit more mechanical on this overview of how it worked, because I think it may be of interest to you. So the states in the Northeast negotiated for about 5 years, and you have the pleasure of being a one-state system here that you're thinking about, and I know you're working with other states in collaboration. But for 5 years, states tried to figure out the design of a program that would enable the region to put a ceiling on the total greenhouse gas emissions that would be coming from power plant electricity generation going forward. So there was a regional cap. I know it's probably a dirty word, but there was a regional cap. There was a currency created by the states, and the currency was that each pound of carbon dioxide would have to have an allowance. It's essentially a ton of carbon dioxide would have an allowance that had to be held by anybody producing electricity, emitting greenhouse gas emissions, and that those allowances would have to be turned in at the end of the year. So there was X tons of carbon dioxide could be produced in the region. The states negotiated heavily a baseline amount of greenhouse gases that each one would have in their budget. Those states each got a share of the ceiling, if you will. And the states had the freedom to choose how they would move those allowances to emit carbon into the economy. And after this agreement was established by a memorandum of understanding by the 10 states, each state then adopted its own implementing laws or regulations to put the program in effect. So what each state decided to do in the end was auction those allowances. There was a lot of discussion ahead of time about whether or not those allowances would be given away for free to power generators. The power generators, in a world in which they had been given those allowances for free, would hold those. Those who were emitting more than they had needed to buy allowances from somebody else. Or if they had fewer greenhouse gas emissions than they had in those allowances, then they could sell those to somebody else. And so there was a trade trading program, in effect. But rather than give them away for free, the states, all 10 states, decided independently to auction the allowances into the marketplace. So that meant that each quarter, a state took one-fourth of that year's budget of greenhouse gas emissions, pooled them, and then there was a simultaneous auction to the market participants or power generators to buy them. This created the opportunity to have the generators selling buying those allowances at a market price. If they thought there was going to be a tight ceiling, the price would go up. If they thought there was a lot of surplus of the allowances, the price of an allowance would go down. So generators bought allowances. The regional REGI program collected the revenues and dispersed them to the states according to their share of the greenhouse gas budget. So over the 12 auctions that took place in 3 years, $912 million were established during that program. So let me describe then how it worked from there. Each state had the opportunity under the Memorandum of Understanding to decide how to spend the money. They had an agreed upon floor that at least a quarter of the revenues would be spent for public benefit. And that was a very broad definition. It could mean anything from using it for low-income customers and to reduce their electricity bills. It might mean that they wanted to use it for general purposes in the general fund. It might mean that they wanted to spend it on energy efficiency programs and thereby displace program money that would be spent by the electric utilities in the region or other things. So this shows you a pie chart for each state about how each one decided to spend their money. Let me call your attention to three colors. If you look at Maryland on the left, and three quarters or two thirds of that is a lighter blue color, that is money that was spent for reducing the bills of electricity customers. So the state collected the money and then dispersed it back out over time to the electric companies, and that showed up on a credit in the actual customer bills that they were paying for electricity. So that's how Maryland spent most of its money. By contrast, New Jersey, just below it, spent two-thirds of its money for general fund purposes. So that's a darker blue. I'm sorry it doesn't show up very well here. But New Jersey decided that they would essentially either fund programs in the general fund or avoid a tax revenue increase and use it for that purpose. The other principal way in which states use the money was shown here in red, and that was for energy efficiency programs. This, as I said, either amplified or replaced money that would otherwise be collected from electricity utilities for the support of energy efficiency programs. So you see the states used a lot of different approaches, and one of the punchlines of the study that we discovered was how a state decides to spend the money has a lot to do with the amount of jobs and economic value created. So let me go a little bit more on that.
Could you say just a little bit more about the difference between greenhouse gas program, renewables, and
yes,
energy efficiency?
Yes.
Those are relatively opaque terms, I think.
Absolutely, and it varied by state.
Yes.
So a use of the money for renewables was a situation where the state had a clean energy trust fund, and they put the money, the proceeds from the auction revenues, into that fund. Some of those were loans to businesses that wanted to start a solar program or some other kind of thing. An education or training program was principally a labor assistance program to help train workers in a state to work on clean energy jobs, installation of solar panels, installation of energy efficiency, or other kinds of things. Greenhouse gas programs were literally programs where the state was concerned about the impacts of carbon emissions on the economy. And so in some cases, Delaware used this, if I recall correctly, for a number of things: wetlands protection to guard against sea level rise and create better holding of sea level rise in the wetlands of the coastal areas and a number of other areas where they were trying to address resiliency in the face of climate change. And then energy efficiency is a number of things associated with helping put in, compact fluorescent lights, insulation in buildings, a variety of other things that was to households, commercial businesses, and industries in the area. Okay?
Thank you.
And please feel free to ask questions along the way. So what we did was we didn't have any judgment about whether this was a good program or bad. What we really wanted to do was see how the money was spent, then trace the money through the economy. So we didn't evaluate whether there would have been a better program design or anything else. We just wanted to report on how it worked so that people in policymaking positions could decide for themselves what to do with that. Next program. Next slide, please. So let me just.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you give us the baseline that you were going to share with us, the measure of the all these things that we're going to see how the money is spent and what happened to it? I noticed in a brief look at the presentation, the assumption is that the money otherwise would have gone to companies that sell energy. But we're never really told what then happened to that money. It's almost as though there's an assumption that those rotten energy company folk put it in their pocket and sit on it, as opposed to something else happening.
Perfect.
So maybe you can give us that, you know, that initial baseline against which your numbers will now be compared.
You didn't realize that you set me up perfectly for this slide. So thank you very much. So what we wanted to do was look where the money went and where it came from, and then how much stayed in state versus moved out of state. So let me try to trace it through, and I'm going to try to answer the question in that way. So the first thing that happens is after the program was established, these allowances are created. Again, it's like currency that you can set into the marketplace. The states auctioned them. The power generators had to spend money to buy them. So the transfer of money from the power plant owners. In our region, power plant owners are not utilities. They're independent power producers. That may or may not be relevant in the sense that they are still companies, some of whose shareholders live in the state and some of whose shareholders are outside of the state. Yes?
This ultimately then could have come from the ratepayers.
Hold on.
Okay. That's the fundamental question.
Absolutely.
That I think Representative Benz and I are looking for.
Okay.
Where did the money come from?
So electricity generators, then when they sell their electricity, they price in the price of the allowance.
Thank you. That's what I wanted to
know. Consumers of electricity pay the full freight of what the power producer spent to get it. Okay. So a coal-fired generator had to have more allowances. It increased the price of a coal plant power more than a natural gas plant, or in both cases, a nuclear generator got the revenues, essentially, of having everybody have to price greenhouse gas emissions into their electricity price, and they then got sales revenue back to themselves. Okay, so electricity producer buys an allowance, they put it in the price of electricity, consumer pays that, and that creates revenues back to the power producer. Okay. So the consumers then, we tracked how much they were spending for electricity. What we did is we actually looked at real prices of electricity over this 3-year period of time. And then what we did is we modeled the electric system without that allowance price in it. Okay, so we said if they were not charging that price, which power plants would have dispatched ahead of others? Because a coal plant is now more expensive than it would have otherwise been. A natural gas plant is a little cheaper. It changed the dispatch, the output of the plants. Nobody could emit more than a total amount of greenhouse gas emissions. So we looked at what the total electricity generating costs would have been in the absence of the allowance. We compared the two over the each month of the year, actually each hour of the 3-year period, and summed the total spending on electricity production. And then because the money was spent in a number of different ways, there was another effect that happened. And actually, could you go to the next slide, which is a picture here?
Just quickly, the word dispatched
okay.
is one that I don't think we understand.
Oh, welcome to my world.
Yeah. and I will tell you that I personally really like the nuts and bolts pieces, because if we're going to devise some kind of a program, we're going to get down into that level.
Exactly. Now, if I do move there, because I want to walk you through something, will you be able to hear me, or are you recording so that you can't? I can't move away? Can I move to the slide?
We are recording, so you need to be near the microphone.
Okay. Yeah. And too bad you guys don't have a rock and roll microphone. I can go.
We're also broadcasting over the Internet.
Oh,
so
horrifying.
We have Oregonians and people in Saudi Arabia, if they want to, can watch this hearing.
They'll just be thrilled, I'm sure. So what I want to show you is a depiction of the world that we examined. On the left-hand side of this picture, could you possibly move it up a little bit or not?
Excuse me.
Sure. Oh, great. I can do it.
So that's working. So you can get
it. Okay, great.
He's got it fixed.
Okay, on the left-hand side of this, you see something that says the electric system effects. There's a box, a dotted box around those. And on the right-hand side is the economy of those states. So the electric system effects are the effects that affect power plant owners and users of electricity. So those are dollars that are spent for the sale and purchase of electricity, and it's all within that system. But then, of course, things move outside of that system when people spend their money differently, if they have more in their pocket because they're not spending as much on electricity, and that's on the right-hand side. So we'll get to that in a minute. So an electric system, such as the one that you have here in Oregon, the utility decides which power plant it's going to run in any time of the day or any season of the year, depending upon how much demand for electricity is occurring. So there's a lot of base load power plants that run around the clock, and then there are more expensive units that just come on peak. They turn on quickly, and they operate just to meet demand as it rises. That's called the dispatch of power plants. And a system operator always has to make sure that all the lights stay on and that they're minimizing the cost of running those plants over the course of a day, over a week, and over a year. So that's all considered to be an economic dispatch decision. And if you thought that it cost a plant with a lot of carbon emissions a little bit more to run because you had to have that allowance, which is tied to the amount of carbon emissions from that plant, a coal plant has twice the carbon emissions as a natural gas-fired power plant. A renewables or nuclear plant has zero carbon emissions from its generation of electricity. So if you're going to put a price on carbon by creating something like a fee, it would affect the relative economics of the plants, and it would affect which ones are going to run more often than not. And that then creates a cost to consumers when they're paying for that, or a savings for consumers. So let me shift for a moment to this. Is you see the RGGI auctions, the power plant owners purchase the allowances, they figure out how they're going to price it to get their money back. They're going to make consumers pay for that in prices. The grid operator figures out which plants to run. And what we did was then figure out what it would have run like without that extra cost for carbon. And we compared the two cases. So what we found was, just on the electric side, a lot of the states spent their money on energy efficiency, which had a double whammy effect on this whole system. If I told you that power plants have to have more expensive power plants operating to meet a high hour of demand when people are turning on their electric heaters or air conditioners. If you thought that there was better insulation in buildings or better lighting and the overall demand dropped in the whole system, you would not be running more expensive power plants as often. And so the total cost to provide electricity goes down when some of the money is spent on energy efficiency programs. So there's this, so one of the things that we discovered was that in the states that spent more of their money on energy efficiency programs, the power system savings were bigger because they didn't need to run their more expensive power plants as often. Everybody had savings over a period of time, even though customers initially paid 1% higher electricity bill, electricity bill in the near term. Because a lot of the money was spent on energy efficiency, that has the effect over 10 years. That's an investment. Over 10 years, electricity customers are going to save because power generation facilities don't have to operate as much. So when we modeled all of that and followed where the money was spent, we determined that in the near term, 1% increase on electricity prices, but in today's dollars, a 10-year savings of $1.1 billion for electricity consumers, even though in the near term, they spend a little bit more. The way it was spent meant that their savings accrued over time. So it was a expenditure on insurance. So then what we modeled was, okay, what happens? The power generators buy an allowance. They get the money back from consumers. That creates revenues to their shareholders. We then tracked where those monies went in a input-output model that I won't describe unless you painfully want me to, but an economic model that's typically used for a variety of programs to understand the benefits and costs of different types of investments in the economy. So some of that money stayed in Massachusetts or in New Jersey. Some of it probably went to shareholders located in Oregon, but it left our economy. Additionally, power generators spent less on fossil fuels. Like Oregon, this region happens to be a place where they don't generate fossil fuels. They don't produce fossil fuels, the Northeast states. Now Pennsylvania does, and New York does a little bit. But for the most part, those states are sending those dollars to Louisiana, to Oklahoma, to a variety of other places. And so spending less on fossil fuels kept more of the money in the economy from the electric sector in the region. Additionally, when the money was spent for general fund purposes, programs in the budgets of those states were continued to be funded. And so what we looked at that was we funded a number of categories in our model that are commercial office buildings or a variety of other things as a proxy for how some of those programs would be spent. So a general fund program, the money either saved consumer taxpayers' dollars and avoided an increase in taxes to cover a same level of budget programs in the state budgets, or it funded some programs that would not otherwise have been funded. So we followed those dollars in the region. When a state spent the money for customer bill reductions, that money is essentially money in the pocket of the consumer. So they spent 1% more out of one pocket for electricity, but they got of savings in their other pocket from this bill credit. And that is, in essence, extra money that they can spend in the economy. Or they can save it. So our model looked at where those monies go for different types of consumers, poor consumers, rich consumers of electricity. And then finally, when states spend money on energy efficiency programs or other things that were funded, then people are hired in those states. There's money spent on materials for insulation, workers to put on insulation in homes, etc. So we followed what those things where those money flows were, and in a net present value basis, those were the bases for the $1.6 billion in economic value created in the region. So that was a net positive. Now, you saw that the losers in this were the owners of power plants, because over a 10-year period of time, they don't sell as much electricity. So when you have a savings to certain consumers, it's really a transfer from the owners of power plants, because the power plants are built and they're not selling electricity. So even though there was an aggregate savings to the whole region, there was this transfer from power generation owners, utilities, or to consumers. And consumers were better off by $1.6 billion. Now, I told you, excuse me, $1.1 billion. Those are not additive dollars. And it's not completely, you can't say, well, 1.6 total regional benefit and electricity consumers got $1.1 billion of that. It's, don't add those up because they're kind of apples and oranges in the numbers. But you can think about those separately. Okay, so now let me see where we are here. I've described this. So this is a picture of what might be of interest to you, which is where the money came from and how much went to the states. So remember that these auctions of allowances were essentially a pooling of each state's carbon allowance budget. So New York always had a bigger share of those because it's a bigger state compared to Delaware, a teeny, tiny state. And they negotiated how much of their of the total budget would be allocated to each state. And so the allowances go out into the economy. The power generators decide how much it's worth to them to buy them. And over time, they realized that as the economy tanked in the region, this was 2009, 2010, and 2011, there was not as much demand for electricity. But people didn't know that in 2009. When they bought allowances, they thought they were going to need more than they did eventually. They were willing to pay more for carbon allowances in 2009 than they were 2 years later because they knew they didn't need to buy as many, and so it was a cheaper supply. So you see here that the big blue bar on the left set of bars in 2009 was the total auction proceeds. And you can see that bar for the 10 states went down over time as the price of allowances dropped. Now, just as a sidebar, the states, these states have decided that they are lowering the cap so that there are fewer allowances to sell, and there will be a tightening in future years, starting at the beginning of 2014, and you would expect to see, again, an increase in price as they are become more dear and tighter over time. And that was in part a design to continue the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions for the region, but also to think about what the price on carbon was that the states were looking for as well. So you would expect to see that as the allowances are going to be priced higher, that those would go up, the revenues would go up as well. In the documentation that I provided for you, it just shows the actual spending across the three-year period of time on different buckets of activity by each state. So you can memorize those when you care to do that. This is the punchline slide that I described a little bit earlier, 1.6 in net present value benefits to the region, all 10 states. States generated $900 million. Consumers got savings of $1.1 billion. Because energy efficiency created a tighter building and it allowed people who use natural gas and heating oil to actually have lower bills for their energy use as well. So there were savings outside the electric system. And then there was $770 million spent in the economy that didn't have to go out of the economy to buy fossil fuels. So I showed here that it's 0.7%. So that's less than 1% rate increase over that three-year period of time. And then it was a savings after that. Now, one of the insights that we observed here is something that I've highlighted a little bit more, and that is that the way the states ended up spending the money had different multiplier effects in the economy. And so you see the three archetype ways that states spent their money. New England states spent heavily on energy efficiency, and because of that double bang for buck with very long-term tail-end savings on electricity bills, a higher amount of savings for the whole region went to New England than their revenues. Okay, so New England's revenues are in the dark black. New England is the six states, Vermont, Maine, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. So those states are pretty small compared to New York and New Jersey. So they got a smaller share of the auction revenues. That's the dark blue line on the left as compared to New York. PJM is it's Pennsylvania, Jersey, Maryland. That's a electrical system, a region. So they're bigger areas, bigger population, more emissions of greenhouse gases. They had more of the revenues. But you can see the light green bar that the share of the savings flowed disproportionately to the New England states because of the way they spent it. And I'm not advocating that you spend the money on energy efficiency whatsoever. But there is a different multiplier effect when you do that because of the investment in spending money to put in the energy efficiency and then the electricity savings over time that accrues from putting in tighter buildings and using less electricity over time. So a couple things were really important as we looked at the state's decisions about how to implement this program. They kept states' sovereignty or their own independent decision-making about how to spend the money and how much they and whether they would give the allowances away for free. What they all decided, as I said, was to auction them. They decided that because if you give the allowances away for free to generators, and they will always put them in their price of electricity because of opportunity cost pricing, which I'm happy to go back around, but they will price that into the price of electricity. It is a windfall to them to give them away for free compared to a situation where the state collects the money and determines how to send it back. You could give it back to electric companies if you auctioned it, or a state could do that. You could give it to consumers like New Jersey did in the bill impact, and Maryland did, excuse me. You can give it to the general fund like New Jersey and New York did, or you can spend it on some other program like wetlands programs or electricity energy efficiency. Those all are completely legitimate decisions of public policymakers in the states, and they have different effects, and they're all, we had no opinion about which ones of these are the right thing to do. And it was important that this opportunity cost pricing, that is the way that a generator will think about a receipt for free of a allowance. Because if they use it and they need another one tomorrow, they have to buy that one. So in essence, it's like replacement cost pricing that they have to do. So I've already described that how a state spends its money is entirely up to a state, and they just had different effects on the economy, all of which are fine. They have different effects in different parts of the economy. I already described that there are out-of-state payments that are otherwise made that are avoided when you're spending less on fossil fuels in a state that is not a fossil fuel producer, like Oregon. There were lots of jobs, and the jobs were a variety of things. This doesn't count jobs outside of our states, so this doesn't count job loss in Oklahoma or Louisiana from not selling as much fossil fuel. So that is not picked up here. This is just looking at the 10 states' economies. But there's a lot of different kinds of jobs that are funded here. Jobs that seem unrelated, where a customer has more money in his pocket because there's savings, because they got a bill impact credit from the way that Maryland spent the money. That means that they could go spend it on they could put it in savings, which has spillover effects. They could put it in buying something that they might otherwise not be able to buy in the economy. So that was free cash flow, if you think of it that way, in the pockets of consumers. And that has spending value in the state. There's a lot of information provided here about the level of detail of what states got in terms of revenues and in terms of how they spent. I'm happy to spend as little time or as much time on that as you would like. One of the things that we observed was the longer a state takes to figure out how to spend the money after the money goes, after the allowances go into the economy, the lower the impacts. So actually, one of the things that I would suggest is if you have a program that puts a price on carbon, and that's either a fee paid by a generator or a price impact paid by an electricity consumer, if the money then is being held by the state and not moved out into the economy quickly, then there's a lag effect. So there's early spending, late savings, and or late use of the money. The reason I say this is, in fact, that the way it worked was at the startup of this program, states were just starting it up. They started collecting money. The money started showing up on electricity prices. I already told you that it was a 0.7% price increase starting in the beginning. But then they had to figure out how to program that money. And then if they were going to program it for energy efficiency, then they had to design the program. And then they had to get it to the utilities. And then the utilities had to hire people to do the programs. And a year later, they're starting to spend the money. So that's a lag effect. The tighter and narrower the gap between receipt of monies and movement of the money, it's a pretty common sense principle that that affects the economic value.
And were there differences in the state?
Yes, there were.
If I'm guessing based on what you just said, I suspect New England got money out quicker than New Jersey did.
Actually, I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that. New Jersey and New York, in the period where each one of them used the money for plugging a hole in the general fund, I'll be pretty crude.
Okay.
That money funded programs in that budget year. And so the energy efficiency ones took longer to get into place. Same for customer bill impact reduction. So if you're putting a credit on an electricity bill of a customer, that could happen, you know, maybe 3 months after you started seeing that in their electricity bills and it started flowing pretty quickly. And that is the end of this formal presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Berger.
Can I just make a comment here? This sounds like the best argument for nuclear power I've ever heard.
Is it not?
I am deadly serious in that comment because we don't have significant nuclear power here, and I don't know about the states that you're talking about, what their nuclear power profile is. But if you took everything else off the table and we're just looking at this kind of an analysis, nuclear power wins big.
So, interesting that you would ask this question. I'm writing a paper on this topic last night on the airplane.
Yeah. Well, I'm correct in that.
So it's a little bit more complicated than that. If you had said this is the best story for zero carbon resources, I would say yes. Renewables emit. Wind and solar and geothermal and water power.
Water, yes.
Of course, I got around to water.
Wave energy.
Wave energy, tiny compared to water in the Pacific Northwest. Yes, right now, exactly. And all of these combined in the United States produce 10% of the electricity. And it's growing. But it's growing even though wind, solar are six times more than they were 10 years ago. It's pretty small increase. And the amount of hydro has remained pretty stable. So it's growing slowly relative to the rest.
So, wait, excuse me, just 1 minute. The 6% you said is renewable?
Six times, 600%.
What is the percentage of renewable?
Oh, 10% when you count.
And is that include nuclear?
No.
Okay.
No. That includes conventional hydro, the Bonneville Power Authority, as well as wind, solar, geothermal around the country. Now, the Pacific Northwest obviously has way more hydro.
Very different profile.
Iowa has way more wind, you know, so it varies. Now, in addition, 20% of the power in the United States comes from nuclear power.
Please, go ahead.
One more question.
Yes.
How does this program, if you know the answer to this, compare with the California cap and trade?
It's different and similar. It's different.
Spoken like a PhD economist.
On the one hand, on the other.
On the, yeah. All right, Mazin, you're smiling.
Remember the Sesame Street, one of these things is not like the other. So the ways that it is different is the California program covers the entire economy. The RGGI program is only carbon emissions on power generation.
Okay.
California program covers cars, industrial emitters, everything, soup to nuts, including things that come in their borders.
Okay.
Okay? So this is just power plants. Power plants across the country and in California, but less so in the West because you have pretty clean electricity relative to the rest of the country. The power sector is still the biggest sector for carbon emissions. So it's not surprising a lot of people would start with the power sector. So that's how it's different. It's similar in the sense that California and the Northeast states or the Mid-Atlantic states decided to auction their allowances into the economy and collect the money and figure out what to do with it. So that way they're very, very similar.
Thank you.
There's one thing that I have not mentioned here which is kind of relevant. The states were very keen on ensuring that what happens if the nuclear plants go down? Let's just say tomorrow the nukes start up operating, the droughts in the Pacific Northwest, your equivalent. What happens if your only fallback is generating in the short term your existing power plants and they're mainly fossil? Does the price of an allowance go, 10 times skyrocket? In that case, you might see very different consumer effects than I described. So in the Northeast and in California, they have what I'll call a safety valve price. If in the auction, a price of an allowance hits a certain price, they'll start printing allowances. And they'll sell them for that ceiling price. So they're still collecting revenues, but they're not allowing that price to continue to keep going up. So they're minting currency at that point and issuing it. And that was important politically in all of these states as a way to assure the trade-off of a tight cap on carbon emissions and an acceptable cost impact on consumers. So I'm just going to say one more thing about your nuclear question. So, yes, those are winners relative today in a world where there's a price on carbon. Right now, all of those zero carbon resources are giving away their value as a zero carbon resource for free. So consumers are, when you add a price, you are saying that carbon has an impact, and we're going to reflect that in prices, and it shifts your positioning of different resources. It makes it more attractive to invest in renewables and things that avoid carbon emissions. It's not likely to be enough in the near term to invest in new nuclear plants because they're very expensive to build new plants. So that was more than you wanted to hear.
No,
sure.
But I am correct in
yes.
It's a premium on certain types.
But of course, in the process, just to follow up along on that idea, that effect would be true for any renewable energy generation system that has zero carbon.
Absolutely.
In the generation of electricity.
Exactly right.
Right. Not just nuclear, but. Exactly. All the others, right.
Exactly right.
Representative Davis, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your very interesting and interestingly presented presentation.
Thank you. A little too wonky, I'm
no,
sure.
No, it was great. It was great. I'm trying to get a grasp on, first question is, for what period do we have actual data?
Mm-hmm.
And then for what period regarding increases in consumer electricity prices, mm-hmm. their bills, do we have actual data, versus projected and then reverted to net present value mm-hmm. Projections for savings.
Perfect. So this was our, I spared you this slide.
And it started in 2009, if I'm correct. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So the program commenced January 1st, 2009, mm-hmm. was still in place at the end of 2011.
Okay.
And we completed our study in November 2011. Okay, so we had
the real data is 2.5 years? Is that what
The real data went up through October, so a little bit more than that.
Okay.
And the real data was price of allowances,
mm-hmm.
how many were purchased, we observed the actual price of electricity mm-hmm. in that period. We observed how the money was spent by the states and when they spent it. So all of that was real dollars.
Okay.
What we did to project something during that period was, so let's think about it. If some of the money was spent on energy efficiency, and we knew that a dollar acquired by auction revenue in the first auction in January 2009. Okay, a dollar was collected there by the state. It moved out to the utility and spent money on energy efficiency, and consumers started putting that in their buildings like a year later. We looked at what they actually spent money on, what kinds of energy efficiency programs, and we looked at what that did to the demand curve
mm-hmm.
for electricity
mm-hmm.
at different seasons and types of year, depending upon how they spent the money. So we adjusted, we knew the electricity model, we changed the actual demand curve to take away the effect of energy efficiency. Okay. Yeah.
Follow up?
Please, yeah.
So we have actual data on price increases through 11.
Yes.
And that was roughly 0.7%
yes.
increase.
Yes.
The projected savings are roughly over 10 years.
Yes.
But we're still in that projection period without under simulated data.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, but let me just describe. We have the actual historical 3 years and a tail end period of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we then, so that's the actual REGI case.
Mm-hmm.
The without REGI case was we changed what happened in those 3 years of the program. And we then dispatched the power system with our model. And in both of the cases, we had the same natural gas price. We had the same power plants. We had a variety of things that were common in the two cases. So even in the out years, we were comparing the tail end effects of the spending in the first 3 years. We didn't try to project, well, what if there's a new program that's adopted in 2015? We just said, in that case, we're just keeping those two things the same in the two cases, and we're not looking at what happens after that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It happened because of natural gas and other things that the actual efficiency of this reducing carbon didn't work well. And now you're saying that they're going to reduce those caps to try to make it work well. What's going to happen now that there's been a 30% reduction in carbon? What's the thought?
Great question. So a couple of things. On your first point, I totally agree that during this period, this is the beginning of the shale gas revolution. Natural gas prices dropped. This region depends upon natural gas to generate electricity heavily compared to your region. So natural gas in the real world, in the actual with REGI world, dropped prices. And in our without REGI world, it dropped prices. So in both cases, we saw the effect of lower electricity bills because of natural gas and its impact on electricity prices. So that was the case in both. And when that happened, it already became, so I also mentioned that during this period, the economy collapsed and people weren't using as much electricity. So electricity is cheaper, they're not using as much, and coal plants aren't operating as much because gas is a better deal to run power plants. So that affected the carbon emissions, and that's why they had a surplus of CO2 allowances. You're absolutely right on that. So what we did was see, would the surplus have been different with and without, you know, what would have happened even with those circumstances, with the economy tanking and with natural gas prices? And so we tracked that difference. And so the states now found themselves with, wow, we've got a whole lot of allowances. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention, I told you about the safety valve at the top end price of an allowance. There's also a floor price. So for the last 2 years, allowances have been selling at the bottom, rock bottom sale price. And that's because they, for a variety of reasons of economic design as well as revenue retention, it remained at that floor. So one is expecting now that as they tighten the cap on allowances, they've set up new rules about how that surplus of allowances can be used in future years, it's going to start to see an increase in allowance prices. Now, I think I've lost the last part of your question as I wallowed on and on.
Well, Mr. Chair, the issue is, if we've had a 30% reduction in carbon, why do this at all? Where's the benefit? If the ultimate benefit has been achieved by some other event, natural gas, why are we doing this? Why don't we just impose a tax and spend it?
So I'm not sure that I agree there's been a 30% reduction. Did I say that's in the report?
If I may, for purposes of my question, assume it.
Okay, that is a hypothetical. That is not actually accurate that there has been a 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Most of these states, like Oregon, have as a state policy in law that they will be moving towards a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2020 and then by 2050. And so the states are trying to figure out an economical way to get to those targets of greenhouse gas emissions reductions. And so they see that even though there has been a small decrease in greenhouse gas emissions associated with using more natural gas and using less electricity, it's still not on target to reach the lower levels of greenhouse gas emissions that are a matter of state policy in these states.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm saying is if we had had that type of reduction, this device would be of no particular value. There's no reason to hang it on carbon anymore than to hang it on whatever.
As I said, I'm trying to be agnostic about states can decide what they want to do. If they have a state policy to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, they might want to figure out an economical way to do that that affects their economy less harshly. If they don't have that policy, they may choose to do something else. And so I'm trying to be agnostic about that. I'm happy to share my personal views about that one, but I won't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Tierney, for being here. Very enlightening conversation. I want to pick up or sort of shift slightly from the questions that have been asked already about pretty technical questions and ask you to be a little more editorial, perhaps. although I've enjoyed that and benefited from those conversations too, it seems like most of your report so far has been pretty descriptive, and I'd love to hear what advice you have for states and what you would how you would advise us. One way maybe of thinking about this is, what do you know now that you wish you'd known, or do you wish policymakers had known at the beginning of these discussions?
That is a great question, and I am literally taking off this study hat.
That's fine.
The question really anticipates a circumstance that will be happening in the United States over the next three-year period, in which the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will be issuing its rules under the Clean Air Act that require states to come up with their own plan for how they will reduce emissions from their existing power plants. So 4 years ago, the United States Supreme Court decided that carbon pollution was a pollutant under the language of the Clean Air Act. And since then, the EPA has been stepping forward to use its authority that it is required to use now to control greenhouse gas emissions. The EPA has indicated that in June of this year, there will be guidance given to the states under this part of the Clean Air Act called Section 111D. And this is a part of the program that affects your fossil steam power generators. So any power plants that you have in the states that generate electricity from natural gas, coal, or oil, the state of Oregon, like all other states, will have to decide how you're going to plan to meet the guidance that EPA issues this spring in draft form and in final form next June. So the sequence is EPA essentially sets a destination point. You guys, have ozone? Do you have smog here? Are you?
We're about to get an inversion.
So forgive me for my ignorance in thinking that Oregon may have clean enough skies that you are not out of attainment for smog under the Clean Air Act. But for decades, states like California...
But we have isolated areas that have attainment problems, but mostly that's because of inversions.
Okay. So
And wood burning for heat.
So right now, under the Clean Air Act, let's move away from carbon emissions for a moment. Smog from cars or from wood-burning stoves. The Clean Air Act requires the EPA to say how clean it's got to get, and Oregon and the other states that are not in attainment has to figure out the plan. And they've been doing those kinds of things for 20 years. I was Environmental Secretary of Massachusetts when our smog was out of attainment. We had to do the smog plan. So that's the way this is going to work under carbon emission for greenhouse gases from existing power plants. EPA will say, here's where you got to be by this time frame, and you figure out how you want to do it. And you can you can either adopt what EPA will come up with as a model rule, or you can do something different as long as you get to the same destination of reduced emissions. And so with that in mind, you might think about either how you want to... Some states will say that power plant there has to reduce its emissions by 10%. You know, that prescriptive. Another state will say, we have this utility, it owns lots of power plants, we want it to decide how it will dispatch its power plants to figure out the cheapest way to get these emissions reductions. The RGGI states are saying this is our way. They will say this is our way that we're going to try to meet it because we think this sets a price on carbon, it reduces the emissions. We don't know if it's enough yet for what EPA is going to be setting as the destination, but that's why thinking about this is important because Oregon will have to be doing something on this state implementation plan, and it will be tailored to Oregon's need by Oregon. You will be submitting this plan from the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. We have a situation where in 2020 we have a major coal plant that will be closing. I'm curious if there were other states under RGGI that had a similar scenario in which you had a power plant closed during that time. What happens to those credits? How does that play out in the marketplace?
Great question. I'm going to answer it for RGGI, but I'm going to also answer it for Colorado, which is probably more like Oregon. And this, I'm taking the RGGI hat, RGGI study hat off. So with the RGGI study hat, there were a number of power plants that are coal-fired generators that were relatively old, relatively inefficient, and for a variety of reasons, including a lower natural gas price, that meant that they weren't operating as much, and they decided to shut down. So Salem Power Plant in Massachusetts is an example of that. And so that means the state of Massachusetts still has the same amount of allowances, because the allowances go to the state, and the state, you know, then sells them, and you would have fewer people trying to buy them because that power generator that was going to be using coal isn't in the market anymore. But it didn't get the economic value under the sulfur dioxide rules a couple of years ago, 20 years ago, that were issued by EPA, allowances to emit sulfur dioxide from a coal plant or oil plant were given to generators. So if that generator decided to retire, they had a pool that then they could resell. And in part, that created an incentive for them to retire if it was part of their cash flow that they could use and sell those into the market. So those are part of the calculation that a state has about whether or not you give it away or you sell them into the market, about who captures the value of those unused allowances. Colorado, by the way, is more like Oregon in the sense that the power plants are owned by the local utility, and Colorado passed the Clean Air, Clean Jobs law, and there was a requirement to figure out whether it was more economical to shut down some of the coal plants and replace them with natural gas, to convert them to natural gas or to do something else. And Colorado went through a major study to figure that out, shut down a couple of plants. They decided that the 3%, I think it was, increase in electricity prices was worth it in the near term because of the long-term savings on avoided carbon costs over time, as well as public health costs from less soot in the atmosphere and things. In that case, the utility got the incentive to convert, in part by making sure that its prior investment in that coal plant was paid off, and it's then going to invest in the gas plant going forward.
Okay, thanks. Representative Baker Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks so much. It was a very interesting presentation. I was curious, I mean, talking about the EPA federal guidelines and how each state is going to be responsible, in your experience in doing this, what's been the impact of doing things at a regional level like Reggie has done versus doing it at a state-by-state level?
Great question. When you think about it, anytime you expand the opportunity space to figure out your cheapest options, it might be a good idea to do that. And so, by extension, let's think about a state where there are 15 power plants that are going to have to be affected by these new rules. And if your only option is to figure out what to do on those 50, let's say it would be much cheaper for the consumers of Oregon to spend money, I know this sounds crazy, to have one of your coal plants shut down, hypothetically, here, and use some of the existing already built natural gas generating capacity from a neighboring state. And it's cheaper to get those carbon emissions reductions that way. That's what the New England and Mid-Atlantic states decided to do. With an expanding pool, you really are looking for the low-hanging fruit across a larger region to do it. I think of the South. The South is a part of the country, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, where there's one company, Southern Company, that serves all of those. And I don't know if you have exactly the same analogy here, but maybe Bonneville would be a similar one where there's similar across-state sales of electricity. Clearly, to me, those three states are going to want to figure out how to help Southern Company find the cheapest pollution reduction across the three states. And so I think that that's one of the values that the accord that the Western states have come up with is helpful, because you can look at opportunities for savings. If you thought that there was tremendous wind power in Oregon that were untapped just because of the Oregon market, but you could sell into California and then get more greenhouse gas reductions, or if you wanted to dam other rivers in Oregon, I'm joking. there's ways to think about it. So there, it's more efficient and probably creates savings to have it a larger region. It's more complicated for states to come up with interstate agreements, though.
We're actually doing both of those things.
Great.
Representative Davis, second time.
I'll pass. Thanks.
Thank you. Madison?
I have a quick question. Usually we have under these regimes the incidence on the taxes and the effects seem to have more regressive type of impacts mm-hmm. on consumers. Under this greenhouse gas allowance, for short, let's call it GAGA, is that apparent? I mean, did you have to deal with this, or did you find a way to mitigate the regressivity of the system?
So I'm going to describe how the states thought about that. But then I'll tell you my opinion about how to think about it. And I really love it that you call it GAGA. I will now take this back as the thing I remember from Oregon, the GAGA tax, Lady Gaga. I told you that Maryland decided to use part of its money to give a credit on bills, and they gave disproportionately high amounts of that credit to low-income customers for exactly that reason. The customers who use electricity who had a less than 1% increase, that's still a lot when you're pretty poor. And so they wanted to make sure that they more than offset that impact for poor customers. And so when we were thinking about how that worked in the states and we modeled that, we made sure that the money went into the pockets of poor people in Maryland more than it did in the other states because of that redistributive effect. You could think about the way New York spent the money on general fund or New Jersey, where taxes that were avoided also are based on income, right? So that to the extent that they were using this money and it was being paid in electricity bills by industries, by businesses, by poor customers, by not poor customers, it was then shifting into an avoided tax with its own income distribution effects. So they thought about it differently than Maryland. And in Massachusetts, for example, what they did is they targeted some of their energy efficiency programs to housing projects and various other things as a way to deal with that. So they just thought about it differently. And there are, you know, we know that electricity prices and the incidence of electricity bills are regressive. People who are poor spend more of their budget, their disposable income, on electricity and energy.
I want to thank you.
Thank you
very, very much for bringing this presentation to us. We know you're only partway through the study because it takes more time in order to get more information. I can tell you that I'm extremely interested in the different ways that the states chose to spend the money, because you've got a built-in, as you know, a built-in study mm-hmm. that you didn't have to set up. That will allow you to look at different interventions
exactly
as a way of determining what actually works best, whatever that means. And if the object is to reduce carbon emissions over time, what that will mean. And of course, you're only partway through the analysis because you're only partway through the data.
In the real world experiment.
That's right.
That's right.
And I personally be very interested in learning more as the more data comes in and as you analyze more of it. Thank you
Great.
So much for bringing this information to us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for your attention.
Thanks.
And for the invitation.
Thank you.
And good luck with Gaga. Ah.
Well, Mazin will keep us in words, that's for sure. Let's go ahead then with our 10 o'clock session on income tax fraud in the federal and state level. What have we learned?
Can I say one
yes,
last thing on this
yes,
previous topic,
do.
Mr.
Yes.
Chair? The Dr. Tierney has agreed to come back and do an encore performance for the Senate Committee tomorrow. But she will also be joined by Michael Gibbs from the California Air Resources Board. So that would be something. And Chair Burdick wanted committee members to know that you are welcome to attend that that segment. It starts at 8:15, but that's 8:15 Senate time.
Okay. Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning, yes.
We won't tell Senator Burdick that you said that.
So on our next topic on the agenda, one of the things I did during my holidays was read my two favorite magazines, Business Week and The Economist. And both of them had major articles about the growing issue of tax refund fraud at the national level as in connection with identity theft and how this was an issue that the IRS is starting to try to deal with and how the states are starting to deal with it. So we contacted our Department of Revenue. We know that they've been looking at this issue. And we've asked a person who is familiar to you. Ken Ross is now over at the Personal Income Tax Division there. And he's going to talk about steps the Department of Revenue has taken and some of the information that they've found.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. Ken Ross from the Oregon Department of Revenue. As Paul said, I'm the Personal Income Tax Program Manager. Since the last time I sat before you, that's changed. The only other thing that I really know that has changed is that my eyes have gotten older also. So Paul asked us to come in and just give a fraud update. So I have I prepared a couple-page narrative and a couple pages of pictures, so I'll go through that real quick. Talk a little bit about fraud, what we're seeing and what we're anticipating, and we'll entertain questions during or after, however it works for you. Oregon is not immune to fraud. I don't think that's a secret. We've had our issues, and some of that's been in the newspaper in the past. It is becoming a growing business. I've read those same articles, although I'm not a subscriber to The Economist. Paul did send me a copy of that one. Typical fraud refund consists of a stolen Social Security number and a fictitious W-2. So they make up the wage and withholding information in order to get a refund. It's difficult to detect sometimes. We do have our own rules-based system where we look for fraud, just like the other states and at the federal government level. What's hard about it is hard to detect, and once a refund goes out, it's almost impossible to get it back because typically we don't know who the person is or where they're filing from. I put a few stats in here to fraud numbers for those of you that didn't see the article in The Economist. In 2012, the IRS stopped about $12 billion worth of fraudulent refunds. They also know their oversight group, the Treasury Inspector General, reported that they estimated they allowed almost $4 billion in fraudulent refunds to get paid. At Oregon, we have the same kind of issue. We're just a much smaller scale. On page 3, the first set of pictures, their table 1 looks at, it just gives the statistics for Oregon for the last couple years. I apologize, I meant to get 3 years worth on there, and I got the years, but only 2 years worth of statistics. This last season, this processing season, 2013, with 2012 returns, we reviewed about 5,000 fraud returns. We paid refunds, fraud refunds that we discovered after they were paid of about $22,000, and we stopped about 2,000 returns to the tune of $5.5 million in this last season. Going back to the federal level, one of the things that their oversight group says they need to be better at is better analytics, and they also need to do more real-time matching of information. you're looking at, Representative Berger has a confused look on her face, it's because you're looking at table two, which I haven't got to yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the things that has become kind of a prevalent, what a lot of states are looking at, which is table two, is commercial analytics. And there are several companies out there that have developed their commercial solution for analytics. Basically, what it boils down to is that they have the large databases. It's called big data out in that world, I guess, where they have collected all kinds of personal records. So every time I apply for a consumer loan, I buy a car on installment, I get a credit card at Macy's department store, I register to vote, I change my address, I move and go sign up for a new account with the electric company. Every time you do something like that, it's recorded and it's out there for somebody to view. And some of these records are public, some are much to be purchased, but these companies have gathered this type of information, and they've developed analytics to run. If we send them taxpayer information, they ping it against their information and they look for anomalies, for so the address history may not add up or whatever it might be, and they give it a fraud score. And so they send that back to the state, and the state determines how they want to treat the fraud score, how they want to treat that refund. A number of states, and this is table number two up there, a number of states are looking at it, and I put a table of just Gentex states. And by Gentex, I mean they use a tax system from Fast Enterprises called Gentex, which is what Oregon is going to, and Eric's going to be up here right after me to talk, give an update on how we're going on that project. So I listed all the Gentex states and what they're doing, and there are a lot of them. Most of them are either have implemented some kind of solution with a outside company, LexisNexis or Thomson Reuters, and or they have implemented or are looking to do that. At the bottom of page one in the narrative, I put just for reference some cost information, and these are made up numbers, but it's just to give you an idea. There is a cost for this, obviously. We've talked with LexisNexis. They quote us a price of, they would charge a percentage of the refunds they stopped. So,
you can expand by grabbing the card.
If we went with Thomson Reuters, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, through Fast Enterprises and Gentex, they've negotiated a flat rate based on the number of returns that we process. So just an idea on cost. I want to talk on page two, talk a little bit about what we did in this last year to do some research in the fraud area and the commercial analytics. LexisNexis approached us and said, hey, send us your information. We'll tell you where you went wrong or what you missed. And so we sent all our personal income tax records for 2011 to them. And they ran their analytics, and they flagged about 93,000 returns as suspicious, and they said that 26,000 of those were potentially fraudulent, and put a dollar amount on that, about $14 million of potentially fraudulent refunds. So, and like I say, this was not a paid event. We didn't pay for them to do it. We didn't get to see the results other than their summary, so we don't know. We didn't get a chance to verify what was accurate, what was fraudulent, what wasn't. It was just numbers. But it gave us some insight, because it gave us some information, like they were able to look at the death master file. So if somebody filed a tax return using a Social Security number that is officially recorded as no longer living, they were able to point that out. We also did some work with a company here in Oregon called Arm Insight, and they have a product called Refund Shield, where they do analytics, but they look at it a little differently. They look at financial information. So every time we had a direct deposit, we sent the direct deposit information to ARM also. So what we sent to Treasury, the automated clearinghouse information, so obviously the name and the social security number of the taxpayer, and then the bank, the routing number, and the account number. We sent what we send to Treasury. We also sent it to ARM, and they were able to, with their contacts or contracts with the banking world, they could run their analytics with that financial information, and they have contracts with a couple of banks where they look at the information the bank stores. So every time you use your debit card or your credit card, that gets stored. It's kind of scary to listen to all this and know what's out there and what they know about you. Anyhow, the project we did with ARM, they did find a little bit of fraud. We stopped 22 refunds, about $11,000. Through them, we realized that we paid 6 refunds for $1,500 that were fraudulent. What really this confirmed, the work that we do in this area of fraud and around the banking, that we're pretty good at. So they didn't find a lot extra that we weren't already catching. So just I'll jump into some strategies. What we're looking at for the future, we know that we have to evolve because the fraudsters, if I can use that word, are evolving. They have this uncanny ability to figure out what taxing authorities are using for their business rules and work around them. So we know we have to get better at it. So some of the things we're looking to do, we are going to continue to do what we currently do, and we have with our own business rules and all our own dedicated staff, because we do catch fraud. When we get Gentax on board with the personal income tax rollout in 2015, we will become part of a data exchange that they do with the other Gentax states, and there's 16 of them. On a nightly basis, they exchange information. So if another state gets a fraud return and they know it, they'll share that with the other states to help them prevent that getting paid out. Gentax also has built in some analytics that will allow us to do better analytics just within our system to look at patterns or whatnot. So we will take advantage of everything that Gentax offers once it's rolled out. We will also are looking at a commercial data analytic product, and we'll be back in front of a committee here in February to talk about that, probably Ways and Means, to talk about the money behind that. FAST, the enterprises, has negotiated with Thomson Reuters to integrate their analytics right into Gentax, and that's one that they've negotiated a flat fee. So we're looking at using that because it makes sense to use something that's integrated. It will vastly improve our ability to recognize and stop identity theft. We're also evaluating a real-time withholding matching program with Employment Department. We're working, developing a policy option package to come back in the 15th session to ask for dollars to build that system and staff what we think it will take to run it. And finally, the last thing that we're looking to do is we're anticipating needing to shift resources within how we do our work, because we know that we're going to flag more returns initially. Eventually, we hope to get better at it, and that the fraudsters won't be coming to our state because we're so good at finding it. But in the meantime, we know we need to shift resources, and that takes me to the last topic, because what we found is that when we flag returns for potential fraud and we don't know until we do the manual review, we also pull in legitimate refunds, and so we know that has slowed down our refund process, which is on that very last topic, that last couple paragraphs. I want to talk a little bit about refund delays, because this last season your office may have gotten a call or two. We got 3 or 4 calls, I believe, about how slow it was getting people's refunds to them. And it was all part of a plot. I say that because it was by design, actually, because when we had the refund fraud of a couple years ago, we went back and we retooled a little bit. We looked at our review process. We strengthened our procedures. We gave staff more training. We suspended more returns, refund returns, and we reviewed more returns. So by design, we slowed the process down. And we also, like I said, we pull in legitimate refunds. It took longer to get them out the door. So looking to the 14 season, that's going to start here in a couple weeks. As soon as the IRS is ready to go, we're ready to go. We looked at it again, and we are retooling again. We know with some of our fraud rules, we suspended some returns that we didn't find any fraud, so we're not going to suspend those kind of returns this next year. We're planning to shift resources to have more people at the peak time to help us get through them faster. So we are looking at it. We are aware of the issue. We know you got calls, and like I say, it was intentional. We were trying to be more deliberate and more focus more on quality rather than quantity. If you look at on the last page is the average days to process a return. It's just some numbers to back that up. If you just focus on the red bar there, that's our e-filed returns. About, I think it was 81% of our personal income tax returns came in via electronic filing this last season. That's about 1.5 million returns. I've got two categories there, suspended and non-suspended. So in our system, it's the processing system's automated. So if everything checks, looks good, it just goes through the automated system. We don't touch it. In 2012, on an e-filed return under the old legacy system, actually that's the blue column, it took about 3.5 days for a refund to process in the e-file world. This last year, we moved to the IRS's modernized e-file. That reduced it by about a full day, so it took 2.5 days if we didn't suspend it. If we suspended the return for whatever reason, and an obvious one that taxpayers are allowed to take a subtraction for their federal tax that they paid, their federal tax liability, and it's by statute it's limited. There's a dollar limit on it. So, for instance, you file a joint return this last year, I think the limit was $6,100. So if you filed a joint return and you claimed $8,300, it would suspend, and we would adjust that. The suspended graph there in 2012, it took us average 26 days to get a refund out the door, a suspended refund. This last year, that jumped up by 30 days. It took us a full month longer, 56 days to get a refund out the door. So those numbers just back up what I was saying, our intentional shift in policy and procedures. Graph number two on that page, just some more numbers to back it up. If you look at the middle two, number of fraud returns, we suspended about 7,000 more returns for fraud, and it's hard to tell because of the numbers, how the numbers line up there. But and the number of refund returns that we looked at intentionally also was up by 5,000. So we looked at about 10,000 more returns for fraud this last year. So it did take more time. So the last table I have on there is just for fun. I don't know if you've ever seen anything like this. So we thought we'd throw some numbers in there just to highlight what our suspense, the magnitude of what goes on in our suspense unit. And this is a group of about 15 people. This is dollar amounts that they adjust. So the first line there is the dollar amounts adjusted greater than zero. So this is where we adjust in favor of the state. So we disallow something, we decrease their refund, or we increase their tax to pay. And in 2013, that was about $58 million worth of adjustments. The second line down, adjustments less than zero, so where we adjust it in the taxpayer's favor. So we increase their refund or decrease their tax bill to the tune of about $32 million. And those net adjustment this last tax season, almost $26 million in suspense. And the total adjustment there at the bottom is about $90 million total. So with that, I'll take questions.
Questions?
Just a quick comment.
Representative Berger.
I was one. You got me. And it was a very easy process. I was fascinated, and the only complaint I had was that they asked for data twice. They suspended, clearly. They asked for some extra data. I provided it, then they turned around and asked for more. If they'd asked it the first time, it'd have been quicker, because I could have provided two sets of extra data, and that was my only complaint with the whole process.
Thank you, Representative. Duly noted. We'll try not to do that.
Yeah. So I just delayed double.
You have a number that you did not pay because of established fraud in the return, and a small number that you did pay, even despite the fact that there was fraud in the return that you simply didn't catch. How many of those people are going to jail?
Representative Barnhart, as of right now, none.
Yeah.
We do have...
you see where I'm going.
Yes, probably. We do have some in the works that aren't through the process yet. Most of these, though, are returns that are filed from New Zealand, not to pick on them, but somewhere in the world, because they can file electronically. We don't know who they really are or where they filed from, typically.
Let me change the question a little bit, make it less inflammatory. Do you have a regular process with the Attorney General to evaluate potential criminal cases and determine which cases are worth pursuing, or is that something that you have yet to set up?
No, Chair Barnhart, we do have a process. We are closely linked with the Department of Justice. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? I have to say I really appreciate this information and the work. The Economist article that Paul referred to makes it very clear that this is an ongoing arms contest, I guess is the way you say it. Between your department and the Internal Revenue Service on one side and the different ways people come up to try to trick you on the other. Those tricksters ought to be in jail. We ought to remove their ability to get on the Internet. There's no way to do that, but that would be a nice thing to do. Because they not only cause trouble for you and for the department, for the people who legitimately pay their taxes, but of course they're also stealing money from businesses and everybody else they can, and causing untold problems for people whose identification they steal. So anyway, that's sort of my bias on it. And I apologize for asking an inflammatory question at the beginning. Other things here. Thank you very much. I assume we'll see you some more.
I'm sure you
as time
yes.
moves along.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Paul, core system.
Mr. Chair, that's our last item on the agenda, is the core system replacement project. And here to update you is Eric Smith, who has periodically updated this committee on the project.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith. I'm the administrator of the Program Management Office for the Department of Revenue, and appreciate the opportunity to keep you apprised of the project that commenced this summer. I get to drive, it looks like. Briefly, what I want to touch on is just to refresh your memory about the project that we're doing. I'll give you right out of the gate what our assessment from a couple of different viewpoints is about the status of the project. Go over a little bit about our approach to how we're going to replace our systems, how the project's being managed, what kind of resources are being engaged in the project, some of the major milestones that we've achieved already and hope to achieve in the near future, and then conclude with the scope and schedule relating to the programs that we administer, and open it up for questions at the end or as we go, however you prefer. Briefly, we conducted a business case. We really just started this journey in 2009, and the primary business drivers for us to replace our systems, it's a capital reinvestment in our infrastructure to maintain the revenues we administer. That's a risk avoidance measure. That's the primary reason we're doing this. Because of the nature of the business we're in and the types of tools that are available to us through improved technology, we will be able to improve performance When we surveyed the landscape and did our due diligence to see what opportunities we would have to modernize our systems, it was apparent to us that the most viable way for us to proceed was with a commercial off-the-shelf or COTS solution. So that's the path that we explored. What I have below there is it's a chart that shows just at a high-level pipeline that we're going to have four rollouts. I'll go into more detail about this towards the end of the presentation. But our first rollout will be the fall of this year with the corporate tax and cigarette and tobacco tax programs, and then a rollout in each of the next 3 years, concluding in the fall of 2017. The way we're executing the project is to implement the Gen Tax integrated tax system that Ken just mentioned in his presentation. We're also acquiring the data warehouse that goes along with the integrated tax system. It'll replace approximately two-thirds of our current legacy system infrastructure. The estimated total cost of the project from beginning in 2009 to conclusion in 2017 is $89.9 million. That total cost includes the $70.9 million that we estimate from when we started in July 2013 till conclusion in 2017. That $89.9 million also includes $11.7 million of the debt financing costs, which we'll be paying into 2024. This is a large undertaking for the department. It's monumental. We've never done anything like this before. And the reason that we've spent a lot of time getting ready was to try and understand how to best approach this. And so I'd like you to know that there are a lot of moving pieces, and we're learning more as we go. We're very aware of the climate in Oregon right now with regard to IT projects. And Mike,
so are we.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
I want to take that elephant out of the room right now.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah.
Specifically?
Our commitment to you is to make sure that we are keeping you informed as we go. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. And as soon as we find anything that we think is of concern, we're working closely with legislative staff and as well as staff at DAS, and so we'll keep you informed. One of the things we do in standard project management to determine how you're doing with your project is you engage a couple of different reference points. One of the things we've done, and I'll talk more about this specific firm, is hired an independent external quality assurance vendor. We're early in the stages of the project. We're just getting up to speed. This is as of about 2 months of their work as of the end of December. But based on their experience in many other projects, overall health for where we are in this stage of the project was green. Our schedule development is yellow. There's a lot of work to be done, as you would expect early in a project like this. In terms of our identification of the deliverables, the risks we've identified, the budget that we've had set aside to do the project, they all think, as of the end of December, we're in pretty good shape. We have an internal project manager who also performs their own independent assessment of the project. They, too, believe for where we were in that stage of the project at the end of December that we're green. They, too, are aware that there's a great deal of work we need to make sure we do well in the next several weeks with our schedule to make sure that it's adequately developed so that we know all the tasks and dependencies that are required for us to do this project well. They saw the budget as yellow, and I think that's primarily because we need to go through Ways and Means next month to reschedule the rest of the funds we need to the rest of the biennium for the May bond sale. And so that's how they viewed the budget. Once we get through the February session and have those funds scheduled, they'll probably see budget go to green. As the sponsor of the project, I would say overall I am a little bit more cautious than they are and say overall it's yellow. There's just a lot we're learning right now. Nothing concerning, but we are being very diligent to make sure that we understand all the things, all the moving pieces that are in place with our legacy systems, the dependencies we have with other agencies that we communicate data with, and we're still in the definition phase and identifying all those details. And until we get all those things in a master schedule, which will be sometime in early March, that's when I'll start to make sure we have the adequate level of resources and the timeline to do the project. So I would say I'm looking at it a little bit more cautiously than they are. They're more experienced than I am, though. Everything is falling into place. In February, we will give a status update to the Ways and Means Committee about the project, much like I'm doing today, as well as go through the process for the funding. Our approach quickly as I said earlier, is to implement the commercial off-the-shelf solution. What that means is we don't plan on doing customization. We really want to embrace the solution that is being presented to us and then adopt our business practices and make sure that our policies and practices adopt to what's inherent in the core system, adopt the best practices. The vendor that we've selected, Fast Enterprises, is a very experienced vendor. They work primarily in a workspace like our workspace, both at local and state governments, to provide systems like we're bringing in with Gentax. The lessons learned we've had from other projects is we negotiated a fixed-priced contract with a cap that is deliverables-based. They've been paid for the installation of the software, and they will get paid once at the end of each rollout if it works. And so that is another thing that we've done to try and mitigate risk, that we will have a functioning system at the end of each rollout. They've done this in 16 previous revenue departments. Alaska jumped in ahead of us. They'll be 17th. We'll be 18th when we finally go live. They've had over 150 rollouts, like we're talking about, and they've been on time for each of those. And so they're very experienced, and they're a good partner to help us understand what we need to do this well. One thing to mitigate risk is to put in a phased approach. And so we started with some small and mid-sized programs so we can learn and cut our teeth. We're doing the corporate and tobacco tax programs, as I said earlier. Next rollout will be personal income tax and then some associated individual tax programs like the estate, fiduciary, partnerships. The third rollout, we'll go back to the business type programs. We'll do the withholding programs and the associated programs with that, other agency accounts and all the other state agency accounts that we service as well, and some of the small programs like 911 tax. The other thing we do to try and make sure we have a successful project is have an established governance and oversight process. The executive steering committee meets monthly. We meet this afternoon, in fact. It is comprised of the leadership of our agency. We're very active with members of the state CIO office and the legislative fiscal office as well, not just for budget, but they also have a technical analyst who's been very involved in helping us in an oversight role for the project. Back to independent quality assurance, CSG Government Solutions is the firm who won the bid. They're based out of Chicago, Illinois. They've got a great deal of experience across the country in a number of different types of implementations. And the thing that attracted us to them is they have specific experience with a revenue agency and specific experience with implementing a COT solution, the COT solution we're implementing, Gentax. So they've done independent QA for the state of Georgia for a project much like we're doing. So that's been very valuable to us to learn from them, from their former experience in doing this. They also have experience in the unemployment insurance world with Michigan, and they were hired to be the external project manager for that project. So they've been very helpful. The other things we're doing that are standard project management methodology, we're bringing in an external project manager, and we're looking for two roles. One is a heads-down scheduler role to help us to line out all the details and tie them together. The other is to bring in somebody who's done this before, somebody who has experience with large IT projects that can help and coach us to make sure we're on the right path. And then finally, and we should know on the external project management within the next week who that firm will be. We're in the final stages of that. And we're in the midst of our procurement process for some expertise to help us with organizational change leadership. Fast Enterprises has experience with that as well. They have requirements in the contract to provide that. This is just to be another third party to make sure that we're doing that well. Just touch on this briefly. We have a program management plan and many sub-plans with documents that describe very in great detail how we're going to manage vendors, how we're going to manage scope, schedule. Those things are being quality control reviewed. We're sharing those with Legislative Fiscal Office, who's also looking at those, as well as DAS CIO. We have regular status meetings internally, monthly, with the Executive Steering Committee. And we also have regular meetings with DAS CIO and LFO. We have quarterly status reports that are required of us to DAS CIO as well, and a budget note requirement to report to LFO twice a year. And so we have a great deal of visibility that we are providing through people being at our meetings, our executive steering committee meetings. LFO staff attend, DAS CIO staff attend, and doing everything we can to be as transparent about the project and the health of the project as we go along.
Are they able to give you feedback and suggestions that are helpful?
Representative Barnhart.
Based on their experience in the other areas that they work in?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, absolutely. They've been very helpful.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we put a lot of effort into getting DAS up to speed on the more in a more general sense on dealing with our IT, statewide IT issues. And, mm-hmm. and I'm hopeful that they're helpful in this kind of a project.
Yes, and Chair Barnhart, they've been particularly helpful with us understanding the independent quality assurance role and how, the importance of not only our internal quality assurance practices, but those of the external role. And so they've been very helpful with that.
Thank you.
Resources, based on what we estimated we needed going in, we received full funding not only for the project, but also we moved a number of resources that were experienced resources from operations to the project, and we've been able to fill behind those positions. We're still in the progress of doing that. So from a budget perspective, we're funded well. We've recruited for 34 positions. We have one more position we'll recruit here soon, and we were able to fill all 34 of those with experienced Department of Revenue staff. Another benefit that we had learned from other states who had done this is you want to co-locate your project team in your facility if you can. There's just a lot of value in doing that, and it adds risk if they're off-site. We were able to, with the Department of Transportation getting into their building, take over a space on the fourth floor, so we have a nice project team space that's working out very well for us. As I mentioned, Fast Enterprises is the primary contractor installing Gentex. They're highly qualified. We finished that contract negotiation in September. We finished contract negotiations, brought CSG Solutions on in October. As I mentioned, their experience with revenue agencies and Gentex specifically, which includes the implementation methodology that is unique to installing a COT solution like Gentex. They're familiar with that. And as I mentioned, we're in progress on the final two contracts for project management and organizational change leadership. To date, major milestones. The first bond sale was complete in mid-November, and we've been able to reimburse ourselves for project costs that we've incurred through that bond sale. We held 9 agency-wide kickoff meetings in November where we were able to provide an opportunity for everybody in the Department of Revenue to understand what we're doing, how it'll impact them, to actually have a preview of what the system might look like. And that was very, very valuable. We even hit all the major field offices throughout the state. And the software was installed in late October. Again, the software is already built, it's been installed, and now we're configuring it to meet our business needs. It was installed and is working, and we've already paid our first invoice for the installation of the software. Upcoming, we have a budget note requirement for House Bill 5008 to provide them with key foundational documents that have been quality control reviewed, and we're in the process of meeting that deadline timely, as well as we met a December 1st note for our first semiannual report to LFO. As I mentioned, I'll provide an update in the February session about the project. We'll have a budget letter that will request continued funding. And we're going to ask to add one more position. One of the things when we were building our estimate of the resources we needed for the project in April of last year is we underestimated the amount of leadership we would need on the project. And it didn't take us long to figure that out. And by the summer, what we had done is double-filled one of the principal executive manager positions. We're going to ask for the position authority to just relieve that double-fill and have that permanently as a part of the project. We're going to be concluding the definition phase and moving into the execution phase of configuring the system and testing it in the next few months. And we're already beginning to develop training plans. And as you would expect with a project like this, there's a great deal of effort going into our data conversion strategies as well. This chart's difficult to read. I know hopefully it's easier to read on OLIS when you take a look at it, but it's all the programs that are in scope for the project and when they'll be rolled out through each of the rollouts. I touched on those a moment ago. Corporate excise and tobacco taxes in the first rollout, personal income tax in the next with smaller programs, withholding in the next. So I hope that's what you're looking for in terms of a brief update for the project. I'm sure happy to entertain any questions.
Questions? This major project, obviously, mm-hmm. biggest one the department's handled in a long time.
Yes, sir.
We really appreciate having periodic updates and how it's going. And the worst thing in the world, of course, dealing with the legislature is surprises. We hate surprises. We like it to be dull. keep it that way, please.
Chair Barnhart, we'll do our best. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Members, I just want to note that we do have a committee schedule established for the session. We'll be meeting Tuesdays through Friday. My plan is Tuesday through Friday, 8 o'clock in the morning for 2 hours. My plan is that when it's reasonable to do it, we will not be meeting Friday, since at least one member of our committee has a direct conflict with another committee at that time. But do plan in your schedule to be available on Friday morning as well. Later on in the session, of course, we will probably be meeting at other odd times as other committees close, just because we don't have any choice about it. But that's the plan at this moment. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you very much. We will see you in February. With that, the committee's adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.